It's just on 18 months now until the centenary of the Gallipoli landings at Anzac Cove. The conventional understanding of what happened on the beaches in April 1915 goes a bit like this. The Australians landed at dawn on the wrong part of the beach with little knowledge of the Turkish defences, led by incompetent British officers who sent them up and off to their deaths. Over recent years, though, new versions of just what did happen on the 25th of April have emerged. And now a new analysis of the role of aircraft in the Gallipoli campaign confirms that much of the common knowledge surrounding the landing is indeed a myth. Gallipoli Air War provides a dramatic account of the war waged high above the Gallipoli Peninsula, when more than 2,000 missions were flown by the aviators of both sides. It's written by Hugh Dolan, drawing on intelligence reports, diaries and accounts of the combatants, along with his own experience as a former RAAF intelligence officer. Hugh joins us now in our Melbourne studios. Hugh, welcome to RN Breakfast.
Thank you, Fran.
I'm ashamed to admit this, Hugh. I didn't even know there was an air campaign at Gallipoli.
I think you'd be in the majority of your listeners. They also are probably unaware.
What was the air capability, the air war capability of both sides back in 1915?
Well, it was quite significant, and you'd be surprised to hear that the world's first aircraft carrier, Ark Royal, operated off the Gallipoli coast from February 1915 until the end of the campaign. You also had tethered balloons, which were attached to steamers, which flew at 3,000 feet and were sort of dragged along the coast. And suspended from the balloon were two men in a basket with a map and a telephone.
On balloons?
On balloons.
Wouldn't they have been sitting targets?
Oh, they were. And they were attacked a number of occasions by the Turkish Air Service and by Turkish artillery. But at the same time, it was worth the risk because these two gentlemen could look down from 3,000 feet onto the Turkish trenches spread out below them. And they could correct gunfire accurately onto these targets.
So they were sitting in baskets with maps and
A telephone.
And telescopes?
And telescopes and binoculars. And what's so grand about this is that they could look down upon the enemy, speak on the telephone, and more or less walk the artillery explosions onto the target they wished to hit.
And so that's the intel that the foot soldiers were working off as they went prepared for the landing. Is that the way it went?
Indeed, and further to this, a squadron of aircraft operated off the island of Tenedos. And in fact, 192 missions were flown before the landing. So this sort of puts the landing basically turns it onto its head, because now that we find that the Anzac staff planners, who planned the landing on the 25th of April, had knowledge of where the Turkish trenches and where the Turkish gun batteries were located.
And I want to come to that in a minute, but just the missions that they were flying. So forget the men in the balloons with the telescopes, mm-hmm. but the flying missions that happened in the days and weeks before the landing, what were they establishing? What were they for?
Well, they were tasked to look for all the Turkish reserves. They knew from a spying in Istanbul that they knew the enemy, what they call order of battle. They knew that the Turkish III Corps was in location, that they had 76,000 soldiers on the peninsula. But what they wanted to find out where exactly they were located, to give them an idea of how much time they had when they landed on the beach before they were hit by the enemy counterattack.
Okay, so that sounds all pretty sensible and well planned.
Indeed.
How does that fit with the version that I think most of us understand about the landing at dawn on the 15th of April, where, you know, the boats with the diggers in it came to shore, the bloody landings, they barely got out of the boats. I mean, it was chaotic. They lost control of their leadership. The leadership lost control of the troops. They didn't realise how many Turkish troops there were on the beach and the advantage they've had.
Well, Fran, it doesn't fit, I'm afraid. And what it does do, it sort of turns the legend on its head, but it replaces it with something better. Because what we have is Anzac ingenuity, in that the Anzac staff, and here we're talking about General Birdwood and General Bridges, used aerial intelligence. In fact, they sent their own intelligence officer, Charles Villiers Stewart, on a flight over Anzac Cove on the 14th of April 1915, 11 days before the landing. And they sent him up in the back of a biplane so that he could look down upon Anzac Cove and see exactly where the enemy defences were located, which he did, which was then drawn onto maps and then issued alongside the orders to all the brigades that attacked on that day.
So Major Charles Villiers Sturt went up in the biplane, and it's a biplane. a diversion to just remark on the fact this was his first ever flight, I understand.
It certainly was.
In that biplane. And he got some remarkable intelligence.
He did.
So what did he find out that was of value to the Australian troops in particular?
Well, he found out that there were over 36 enemy gun barrels, that is, artillery pieces, mm-hmm. covering the landing beach called Zed Beach. And that was actually, rolled into the Anzac planning. So they determined that they would land at night, not at dawn, and conduct a silent assault. So they wouldn't, as the British did, have an hour's preliminary bombardment and land in daylight in their white-painted rowing boats. No, no, the British did that at Cape Helles. Instead, the Anzacs landed at night, an hour before the dawn, in total blackness and in total silence. More or less a surprise assault. And they did that, and within 25 minutes, the beach environs was taken.
So, again, how does that fit with the notion that young Australians got mowed down as they tried to move up the beach? That those 36 guns waiting there for them, that they were sitting ducks?
This is what's so great about it is they did not get mowed down. In fact, you can look at the Australian War Memorial website and you'll see photographs taken on the 25th of April. And you'll see only one body on Anzac Cove on the beach. So... it was a total, that the actual amphibious phase was a total success and was reported to the British general as a total success. What, of course, happens later in the day is that you have the Turkish counterattack from Mustafa Kemal's division from the little village of Bagali, which the Anzacs knew about and were prepared for.
Mind you, there was the initial wave may have been conducted in silence and in the darkness. I'll come back to that. But there was wave upon wave of landing. So was it these later forces disembarked to the beach that got mowed down?
No one got mowed down. There were casualties, particularly on the small destroyers that were ferrying troops back and forward from the transports. You'll have to understand, Fran, that Anzac were loaded off steamers, not warships, in their later echelons. So the warship, the steamers were unarmored and did not want to get too close to the beach because, of course, the artillery barrage that was fired over the cove. But the landing on the beach below the cove was protected. It was what they called defilade, that the enemy could not reach it with their artillery bursts, so that they could more or less land in protection.
You're listening to RM Breakfast. It's 14 minutes to 9, and Hugh Dolan is our guest. His book, Gallipoli Air War, tells the story of the role of the fighter planes and other aircraft in the Gallipoli landing and the Gallipoli campaign. Just to stay with the version of history, what you've unearthed is that rather than being led by the British, the Australians did run their own show there, and using their aerial intelligence, we've talked about emerging technology, innovative tactics to develop this land for this quiet landing at the beach in the dark. Tell us about, I think there's something about using velvet to mask the sound of the landing. Tell us more about that.
Indeed. The Anzac headquarters was innovative, and part of the silent assault was to ensure that there were no signals or they didn't give away what they were doing in the actual darkness around 3 a.m. So carpets were ripped off the floor of the officers' wardroom and laid across the decks of the warships of the initial wave. So you didn't have the crunch of their boots as the men walked along the decks. And of course, there was no smoking. And the troops in the first wave landed with their rifles at the unload. So there was no, accidental discharge of their weapons. So the whole set of orders was to give the men the greatest possibility of landing on the beach undetected. And in fact, we do know that the Turks didn't start firing on the first wave until their boats had actually grounded upon the shore.
And Hugh, there's some fantastic stories within your book about the role of the aircraft in the Gallipoli campaign. One, tell us the one about the pilot who dropped the leaflets, even the sixpences, into the Turkish trenches, and what was the point of that?
Look, that was Harry Strain, and what we find is that aircraft were involved in every part of the campaign. They were involved in collection of intelligence, as we've just described, and they were also involved in psychological operations, and that is dropping leaflets over the Turkish lines to tell them, look, please surrender, we'll look after you well. And what Harry Strang did is he went a little further and he collected letters from prisoners of war and tied them or bunched them around sixpences to help them, you know, to fall in a weighted bag and to give the Turkish troops some incentive to come and surrender. I'm not sure how effective it was because, of course, I don't know how many Turkish soldiers could actually read. Certainly their officers could. But the use of psychological operations right through the breadth of the campaign.
Hugh, it's a fascinating version of the Anzac story. You know, I'm always surprised by how many different versions or perspectives on this campaign there are. Yours is from the air, and some great research has gone into it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Fran.
Hugh Dolan, and his book is called The Gallipoli, The Air War, The Unknown Story of the Fight for the Skies over Gallipoli, and it's published by Pan Macmillan.